Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Masonic Companion. I'm your host for the next while, Dale Graham. Thank you for tuning in, coming back, or welcome if you're new to the program. I think we have some interesting topics, primarily of interest to people with a tendency toward taking Masonic, but the principles, the philosophy, and the ethics of Freemasonry are worldwide. They're universal. They touch on all of the major religions in a very respectful way, and that's caused, a resurgence of hope for a lot of people that humanity can live in harmony, but it requires work first, and we're part of that. We're part of the workers. We like to think of ourselves as builders. We have not only work that's purposeless, but it has a meaning and a plan, and that plan doesn't come from us. It comes from a greater sense, and if we had all of the answers and could define it all, we would be strive to be humble. In fact, I think, like a lot of people, a lot of situations, we find that even if we stumble over the insights, we tend not to brag about them, but we tend to try and understand them and understand what it is that we've discovered. And particularly, as you can imagine, after a lifetime of searching, we might want to check our figures twice. And if you don't mind, maybe we're the kind of people, you and I, that tend to do that, not to hesitate, but to build on what we know. So, as you know in the program, we talk about things that are sometimes difficult to bring up inside the walls of a lodge, particularly when all of the ingredients for thoughtful discussion aren't present. Not everybody has been given simple the instruction. You may think that it's intuitive, but it isn't, about how to carry on a thoughtful discussion without losing one's temper, without becoming aggressive. That, you know, determining that fine line between poor taste and asserting a being firm and asserting a point, and to be able to do that and feel good about it. Well, we read about those incidents of great debate where the antagonist and protagonist can walk away feeling shaking hands and sharing a drink and have had respect for the process. That, and we hear about the great debating societies of the world, of the older and newer universities, and others, where the two teams don't get to pick their topics. They're given a topic. So What we may not have in lodges is clarified by that process. When you're handed your topic and your focus, whether you're for or against something, whether you believe it or not, what if it encourages a man to do is to look at the world differently, to begin to understand points of view through the eyes of other people. And once we do that, well, it's done for an advantage. The advantage is that we're able to understand. When we begin to understand a phenomena, it doesn't necessarily mean that we agree with it, but it may absolutely help us to understand, to come to some clarity about why things are so complicated that seem so simple. Well, if we begin to, and this is always the beginnings of thought, the beginnings of ideas. So sit back and enjoy a little bit. We have some good music today and some, I think, scintillating conversation. There's never too much patience in the world, never too many smiles, never too much good time. But we can try and make that happen with each other today. This is an exceptional day. This is the 27th of May of 2014, the 117th day of the year. Things are not exactly zipping by, but the year has been, the winter has really wanted to stay. It's like it's in the throes of going, and we have to whisper to it, don't worry, you're going to be back. You're going to be back in 7 months, we're going to see you again. So it's just temporary, but it clings. That's the one thing about winter. It's sort of this cloying, clingy kind of season. It's not like summer. Summer comes and it celebrates, and it's wonderful, and it's this explosion of growth and comfort. And it doesn't suffer for a lack of confidence. When it goes, it goes. It's like, if you didn't make the best of me while it was here, that's your problem. I'm out of here. I've got to rest or recharge for next year. Winter comes. It doesn't really feel like it's welcomed, except when you think about being here in Canada, where we look for it because we know what it brings. It brings it puts the Leafs on the ice one more time to do whatever they do. It means the golf courses are closing. It means that we're going to see these beautiful panoramas. The trees are going to be without leaves, which means we can see through the forests, without the shadows. It's a phenomenal time of year when we begin to embrace the seasons like we do. So we're saying goodbye to all of that. Spring is around, and we, instead of looking at the brown and the murk that the thaw has left behind, what we catch ourselves doing is looking for those little, shades of green that are popping up. And, we'll even look across the tops of the grass and the trees just to see it, and son of a gun, there it is already. So sit back and relax, and I'm going to try and like to tone, put us in a reasonable frame of mind with a reasonable bit of music. And then when we come back, I'm going to talk to you about birthrights, whether you feel it's yours or ours or a birthright that is Freemasonry, is part of the initiatory process. I want to talk a little bit about what we've done with that birthright, and Sherry, throw out a few opinions and see what you think about it. Meanwhile, I'd like you to sit back and listen to some, this is a beautiful piece of music, and it's reflective. If you're sipping on your cappuccino or your espresso this morning, or you've got your favorite beverage this afternoon, or if you're sitting there this evening with your tight fist wrapped around a glass of wine, enjoy this. It's just a couple of minutes of what I think is some of the finest instruments that I've heard in a long, long time. This is from an opera called Lakme, and this is referred to as the flower duet. I think you'll see what you think. Just a little taste. Something that puts us in a frame of mind. When you listen to the music on this program, I hope you have that sense. Give yourself that moment just to close your eyes and experience what the music does with your thinking and your emotion before you judge it. Before you judge it. Is it simply that we want to hear something that's familiar? And if that's what you want, certainly I can't think that this show is going to be very helpful for you, because you're usually pulling ideas together and trying to be look at things in a new way that refreshes and gives us some answers. So there you have it. That's the whole piece is striking. Yeah. Beautiful piece of music. I wanted to get back and talk to you about birthrights and things that we sort of inherit, things that we can believe that are ours. If we believe that there is this sense of ownership in the world, other than what we've created in our own mind, who really owns anything? We don't own the mountains. We don't own the air. We don't own the oceans. We don't own the land under our feet, except that we create these contracts and rules that as long as I'm on my patch and there's rules about it, you stay on your patch and we're good friends. And we'll have rules about how we communicate and what we communicate. rules about what manners are about, what's the difference between bad form and intolerance. And it fluctuates, doesn't it? If you've ever been in those groups where everybody's on the same page, so to speak, it's wonderful, where everybody gets it. There's just harmonics. And then there's the likes of you out there that go about searching out harmonics, where you meet somebody on the street with a smile, and you know, when you ever say hello to somebody, and they almost seem shocked or startled. They're not quite sure what to do. What's your game being friendly? What are you up to? What do you want from me? Are you going to attack me? The world, I think, I'll put this out there for you. I think the world is in far too often in a state of anxiety. And we come up with big guns that try and protect us as we become little. Our sense of being big men, big people, shrinks. And we replace that with armor and rhetoric and this notion that we're impenetrable, that we're all things to all people. And if we close the blinds and talk as human beings, we find that it's predicated on anxiety. Something happened to other people, and it happened before, so it's going to happen to me, and I'm considered foolish if I live in a state of trust and agape. Really? Where's that getting you? Where's that thinking getting you? Feeling any safer today than you did 10 years ago? I hardly think it. I made your gun a little bigger? How's that working for you? Not really working, because everybody gets a bigger gun, doesn't it? It's almost like we sit there and watch and begin. If we begin to believe what the media, the salaciousness of the media, you know, they're just trying to sell product out there. They're not trying to necessarily explain what's accurate or truthful. Certainly, our politicians have forgotten that. This is about power, and remember, you're the power of the mind, the power of free will. A lot of people paid for that freedom with their lives. And for us to act ignorant about it would be to insult the sacrifices of so many. And I think there are people that may be indifferent to that, and so be it. I don't think I could live a life and feel good about myself if I was to do that, to, you know, ignore the rights that I've been given, the birthright, to protect my sense of freedoms and let some loutish person who claims to be a leader make decisions for me without really considering the merit of them or reasoning them through. That's shameful. But the work of it is to realize how natural it becomes for us to come to that day when we sort of have that awakening where something's going on and we realize not quite right. And then the question is, what can we do about it? Well, think big and operate small, as I often say. Think big, keep the big picture in mind. But what can you do? You can be the source of that harmony. Be the source of the conviction that when something does not seem right, there's probably a question to be asked, and there is absolutely nothing wrong with asking questions. And often when you ask the questions, you can disturb some sensibilities that may or may not, and often are, history and experience teaches us, are the result of poorly thought out ideas. Don't you love it when somebody is throwing authority at you because the idea that they're working with is half-baked? One of the most, try it, fascinating. You see these half-baked ideas and somebody's up there with their, you know, vein popping, spittle dripping down their jaws, that nice penetrating look on their face because they're covering up something. Their idea is just shriveling even as they say it. It's half-baked and it's withering. So Those are the very best conversations to be when you can discover truths. What you discover is how resistant minds can be to truths. Look at our roots in Renaissance. If you want a proof of that discussion, look at the reaction. Well, it's not embraced. It was a lot of it was upsetting the apple cart, put some people in power out of sync. Their gears were crunching a bit. So, Ty, here I have a question. I start this off with a question today. Have you seen these deemed at the over 50 crowd about drunk driving? With an elephant in the room, a man obviously intoxicated pulls out his keys and heads for the car. And you see the usual scramble, like people looking at each other, say, "Oh, geez, what do I do? You know, do we stop this guy? Oh, there's the, you know, well, of course there's going to be this this busload of blind orphans that are going to be killed because of this guy. Well, yeah, theoretically there's that potential, but there's more likelihood that he's going to go out and kill himself." And we want to perhaps stop that, do we? You know, are you your brother's keeper? And we want to take away that unnecessary risk of trivializing the value of life. So, you know, those little flash moments, we're asked to face our sense of conviction. And it's not always comfortable, but we can even see these cartoonish elephants floating around in the background if the producer director wanted to make it that obvious. But today, there are countries that have understood that this approach, talking about the elephant room, is high risk. Convictions for driving under the influence range from a lifetime driving ban, like it is in some Scandinavian countries. I don't know if all of them, but I know Sweden, to costly fines and suspensions. Here in Ontario, if somebody gets caught, even the first time, and they haven't done anything, they're just a rolling stop, and somebody catches, you know, police are fine, the cost roughly is around $16,000 and up for placing people at thoughtless risk. Not the fine, but the insurance. They're coming to get you. And these days, baby, you're screwed. So, and you know, it's not like rocket science. They look at the risk factors, and here's the risk factor. When the over 50s were boys, over 60s particularly, there was a tolerance. It was a different time, wasn't it? Whether we were aware of the risk, it was still there. Of course, those were the days before airbags and seatbelts and padded dashes. And you were driving 2 tons of Detroit steel. And there was a tolerance to make sure the fellow could get home safely. And less perhaps to more, that was considered part of community. And yes, we knew about the dads and the brothers and the husbands who had drinking problems and were in that state of mind every time they came home from work. And we know about the violence and the moral decay that happened about that. Yeah, we know that. And we know about that today. But we grew up with this notion in our mind that there was an acceptable level of drinking. So we are taught still this belief that if you only have one or two, it's okay. Well, we know that that's a fool's paradise. The risk, if you're a gambler, you want to place your bet that is going to screw up, because that's you're betting on the house when you do that. And it's because of all the mechanics. People lose track. You have one, you have two, and it feels good, and you're having a conversation. It's like my friend was telling me about putting artificial rum flavoring into a cake, and people were eating the cake and starting to act as if they were intoxicated. Yeah, she didn't tell him that it was artificial. There wasn't a drop of a molecule of rum in the cake, but she had mixed it in with different fluids, milk, and things like that. And people felt that they were taking in rum because it was a strong flavor. And so you take in rum and you get drunk. A lot of this is the impression of the mind, of course. The intoxication, though, does happen to a human brain when we take in too much. Anyway, that's not what the point of this is. A tiny little snapshot of cultural maturity, that's all that that is. So I've always been fascinated by that process, especially the reaction of a group confronted with the elephant in the room. And yes, Freemasonry has them too. Today I want to talk to you about a large, very old elephant, beautiful old thing. Once we were exclusive, weren't we? Think back in the day. Even the process of initiation defines exclusivity in a particular way. It's not signing up. Even though we have this rubber stamp process where anybody coming to the door, in fact, my goodness, we've replaced this with so many different forms, politically massaged forms of recruitment that, you know, we have places with billboards. We have people handing out, we've seen this in Ontario, people handing out membership applications to folks they don't know. Or they call knowing somebody, meeting them once. That's it. Strange times, huh, wouldn't you say? So, elephants in the room, my goodness. Today, we happily give memberships to disinterested men. And then, oh shock, oh my goodness, we wonder why the elite choose instead a massively expensive Tony Golf and Country Club. Kills the breeze. Why would a well-rounded, successful man want to associate with people who lack self-discipline? Unremarkable, underachievers, and obsequious. Why? Why? Well, they wouldn't. They wouldn't. The constant recruitment doesn't stop. It never stops. It occurs at every meeting. The solicitation, every single meeting. There is much about Freemasonry that is fundamentally rewarding. So if you're thinking, oh my goodness, this is a malcontent, you haven't met me. You haven't met me. Far from it. And I don't think any of you are those malcontents. We're examining things from the other side. Hmm? Giving out the birthright of intellectual exclusivity is not, that's not fundamentally rewarding. What we can agree, I think, that it is a daunting task to think about how to regain that high ground. So vexing, many discussions end in a frustrating impasse. I wonder, is that because we are collectively insecure about the foundations of Freemasonry? I don't know. Are we unwilling to pay the price that it would take to regain that that ground? Or are we lacking vision needed to impart a sense of exclusive right to our fraternal order in a landscape where equal has become a step down? How did that ever happen? This is difficult, or, and this is what I'd like to, I need your advice again, gentlemen, is, are we swinging at, are we Don Quixote swinging our sword at windmills? Hmm? Are we, did this condition ever exist, this sense of exclusivity, did it ever really exist, or is it a product of the compression of history, that we saw great minds here and there and there, and when we write about them, we can begin to believe that those brilliant people were markers of the general attitude at the time that was prevailing around them. And I don't know if that's accurate. I don't really know. Because that said, it's the same today. We have some really sharp operators around. You've met them. Articulate, thoughtful, reasonable, well-mannered fellows. And they accomplish a great deal. Yes, we have our politicians. Even within this envelope where we operate without politics, we know that there is
it's formed in a particular way. It's spoken about in a particular way, but it is, and not but, it is there. It's the nature of mankind. It's the nature of when large groups, that there is stratification. There is. And there is competition. Yes. So we can suppress that, repress that, but to ignore it, to, I think, is shutting our eyes to an elephant in the room. I also think that that high ground, think big, work small, work your plan. Every tradesman, every engineer knows you plan it out. Every mature tradesman, mature engineer, mature architect knows that you sit down with your that's part of your team that you need to have a complete understanding, a shared dialogue to make the beautiful things happen. And if we're fortunate, we would add an artist into the mix. If we're fortunate, we're not there yet, my goodness. To be able to sit down and talk with the artists, no. So we will continue to look at the past as if it was the golden age, inescapable and beyond our grasp, as long as we harbor these sacred, these elephants in the room, sacred cows and elephants. You know, the livestock is just, I'd like to open the doors and let them out, quite frankly. How to do that? Talk about them. Admit they're there. The first start of change is just to admit that they are there and begin to understand what they tell us about ourselves. Those days of grandeur, those impressive periods, who's to say we don't have another pivotal moment coming ahead or around us in history? Who's to say? You? Because it doesn't, it's not written with a quill and pen, a quill and ink. That's all you got. There's a great deal happening around us. We like to think of it as accelerating. Well, it's not accelerating, it's paying attention. And when we begin to pay attention, we realize that this library that we have entered, and my goodness, this laboratory that has been open to us through the initiations of Freemasonry is massive. It is massive. And here's the humbling part. For all the polymaths aside in the world, it is more than one man can grasp. So, Lord, we need each other, don't we? We need each other. We need your expertise, your curiosity, your findings. And we need that trust that your work is at the caliber that is precise. Now, we don't stop until we have the authenticity of scholarship behind that. And we try very hard to keep our scholars and our students unsullied, uninfluenced by outside interference, particularly the dreaded business interest, because we can't tell, we can no longer tell what it is we're dealing with, the political interest that we've heard shamefully in Canada over the past, 8 years, where the interests of the political stability has superseded the findings of some remarkable research scientists. So the truth, the governance, the authority of the country, it rests on our shoulders. You and me and people like us. Our representatives are just that. They are doing a job, but they are never you and me. Never. I want to, enough. So write to me, tell me what you think. Or look around for the elephants in the room. Remember, I've gone a bit off the rails with my belief that we will one day have a proper Grand Lodge Hall. I wonder why, well, I don't so much wonder anymore why we don't. It's sort of obvious. We've been distracted, again, by the defining of Freemasonry as a governance and structure. Well, my goodness, how in the world did that one get away from us? Did anyone see that one coming? I thought Freemasonry was about principles, ethics, philosophy, a way of life, a way of thinking. How wrong I was. It's about structure and authority. And status quo, not going to work for me, I'm afraid. It's all necessary. All of those things are necessary in order to protect us so that we can go about our business inside the framework. What that gives us is a responsibility to carry on the birthright that's been handed to us. The birthright, as fragile as it might be, as vaporous as it might be, it's there, and you and I know it. And in our discussions and in our manner, we always need to rely on the inclusion of everybody. We want to make this ship sail, but we want to make it big enough and stable enough for everybody. The malcontents will be the malcontents. Maybe we'll put them at the stern. Okay, but we shouldn't expect them to go away. They're a necessary part of that balance in the conversation. They're the counterpoint, the other side of the debate that gives us a sense of purpose rather than working on every single idea as if there's only one way. That's what was the great part of the great change of the Renaissance, was that one-way thinking, that prescriptive thinking was done away. It vanished, and my goodness, what do you and I have to gain from all of that? Reason. Reason. We have now an expectation that we reason through the large issues for ourselves, or not, but we have nobody else to blame. Nobody else who can't point a finger and say, well, we're being oppressed. Yeah, okay. The matter of choice makes it harder. It's easier when we can be led around like sheep. In a way. Except it's not tolerable. As we know, history has taught us. Anyway, let's get on with things. Elephants and sacred cows. Watch the manure. Anyway. The importance of Masonry, can I talk just a little bit? I know some of this can get a little, you're not going to hear this kind of conversation about neoclassical architecture anywhere. Maybe I'm talking to, out there to a whole gathering. I don't know what you call a gathering of neoclassicists. What do they call it, a gaggle? I don't know. But here, I just need to touch this stone and then move on, just so I can, in my head, have a sense. What in the world are we talking about? We have this sensational, metaphoric connection with architecture. One would think we would be able to articulate what the hell that means. Answer, why? Maybe we'll put a little stone into that wall and help you build part of it. The cathedral that we're building about, you want to see the cathedral that we're talking about here and why there's a purpose to this, the point to the architects and neoclassical architecture, look in the mirror. There. That's the cathedral. Not too pretty, isn't it? Yeah. Needs work. Showing age. Oh, my goodness. Not as beautiful as it could be. So, if you're a builder, take a look at it, put up some plans, write them down, and get at it. Get at it. The work's not going to get done on its own thinking about it. Well, we do have to, and think of it as an artistic adventure, that you're building something artistic. So the importance of Freemasonry in the history of neoclassical architecture is considerable, of course, especially where the Egyptian revival elements are concerned. The idea of Egypt as a source of knowledge of building and of all wisdom enshrouded in hermetic mysteries was well known to Freemasonry. The craft of Freemasonry itself was traced to Egypt. The Israelites were supposed to have learned the skills of building on stone from the Egyptians. And as we have seen, another version has it that Abraham passed on secrets to the Egyptians. And there was a close connection between the story of captivity in Egypt and the use of the cubit as a unit of measurement and the legends of the craft and the Solomonic temple. In most of the legends, masonry, as the craft involved with geometry, building with stone, measurement, and the creation of architecture, was also the guardian of sacred esoteric knowledge passed to mankind from the Creator. Freemasonry in the latter half of the 18th century reflected many of the philosophical, moral, political, artistic, and intellectual currents of the Enlightenment. Liberalism and progressive notions were implicit in Masonic ideals of the Brotherhood of Man, and continental Freemasons seem to have held little brief for the Roman Catholic hierarchy and its most reactionary pronouncements. Indeed, many of the commendations, threats, and bulls of those official orders seem to have had little effect during the apogee of the Enlightenment. They were there, but blow it off. And maybe I'll do a show. We'll talk about what's going on right now with the Francis effect. Remarkable, remarkable. First Jesuit Pope. What are those thinkers about? A ceremonial setting using motifs from ancient Egypt would seem to be logical, given Masonic belief in Egypt as the source of skill and wisdom. Yet an Egyptianizing theme in Freemasonry does not appear to have surfaced much before 1750. Although overt Egyptian decor was used to great effect in the chapter room of the Supreme Grand Royal Arch Chapter of Scotland in 1901, and in Freemasons Hall in Dublin, 18th century British lodges do not appear to have embraced the Egyptian style with much enthusiasm. Continental lodges, however, notably those in France and Central Europe, acquired certain Egyptian features. The main influences in this transformation were Count Alessandro Cagliostro, he was born in 1743, and Carl Friedrich Kolpin. Cagliostro's supposed real name was Giuseppe Balsamo, and he appears to have been an unscrupulous charlatan. Our kind of conversation. He passed a dissolute and criminal youth and is supposed to have studied alchemy in the East. Well, I guess in those days, who didn't? If you had a bit of a brain going on, Newton did. Anyway, the Royal Society, full of alchemists. Oh, I'm not sure that's a bad word. Can I say that in front of the audience? Alchemy. In Europe, he peddled drugs and potions and became a Mason in London in 1777. He later became Grand Master of a lodge in Paris, to which a temple of Isis was attached, and claimed to be deputy of the Grand Cupra, who had not been seen by anyone. In 1785, Cagliostro was implicated in the affair of the diamond necklace, in which Jean de Saint-Remy de Valois obtained a possession of a diamond necklace by duping Cardinal de Rohan, and although Cagliostro was acquitted, he was imprisoned in connection with other frauds. British Freemasons regarded Cagliostro and his Egyptian rites as fraudulent, but nevertheless his rituals were speedily adopted in some French and German lodges. They must have been fun. They must have been interesting. Oh, let's not forget that every so often Ferrari or Maserati produces a car, and we might be too broad in the beam to sit in one anymore, but when we look at the lines, We hear the engines throbbing. Well, of course, new and innovative. Well, let's put an end to that. So we don't like it, but we can read it. We can study it. But you see that some of these lodges were adopted. Yes. Klopfen published a curious work on the rites and initiation of the Egyptian priests in 1778. And this work became influential in continental circles of the craft. It is clear from typical standard designs for Masonic certificates for lodges under the Grand Orient of France that the Egyptian element was well to the fore. Pyramids, Egyptian columns, palm trees, sphinxes, and Egyptian Isis or Hathor-headed capitals are much in evidence. A French master mason's apron of the circa 1800s, printed from an engraved plate, shows Egyptian features with busts of Cambyses, pro-grand master of the Grand Orient, and Napoleon. While the design clearly owes something to the Egyptian campaign of Napoleon, the Masonic elements are clear. From the description of the Egyptian rites, it seems that they derived from Issaic ceremonies in ancient Egypt, but especially in the Greco-Roman world. An antique pavement of mosaic from Antioch, for example, shows the Mors Voluntaria with the initiate when the initiate goes fearlessly towards the unsheathed sword, the important moment of initiation in the House of the Mysteries of Isis. The idea of a trial, even of voluntary death, where faith triumphs, has its parallels in Masonic literature, Issaic ritual, and Christian martyrology. As the theories of Laugier and Herder, the influence of Piranesi, and the rediscovery of the antique first of Roman, given a further impetus by the rediscovery of Herculaneum and Pompeii. You know, they were covered by the volcanic eruption. Then of Greek and finally of Egyptian examples drew architects and designers away from the frivolities of the Rococo to a more severe expression. Clear geometrical shapes were exploited. The frontiers of taste were pushed further towards ever greater ruggedness, massiveness, and primitiveness, and the search for simplicity led naturally to Egyptian exemplars. Young French architects began to experiment with huge forms, simple massing, and symmetry in the academies of Paris and Rome, using public buildings, monuments, cemeteries, and vast civic structures as their subjects. Étienne Louis Boullier was the visionary architect and leader of a whole generation of architects who experimented with unadorned walls, simple forms, and a massive megalomaniac scale derived from Piranesi's views of Rome and other drawings. Oh my goodness, you look at Rome and all the history and then you say, well, we've got to do that here. Let's do that here. Well, that must have been a bit daunting. Boullier's designs were cenotaphs and cemeteries, and they chose buildings in which Egyptian motifs play no small part. Huge blank walls emphasize the terror and finality of death, expressive of Boullier's ideas of an architecture suggestive of its purpose. And so you're looking at the building and it reveals the purpose of the building at that kind of a level. Remarkable. Neoclassical sarcophagi, pyramids, and funerary triumphal arches, by cutting all adornment to the very minimum, Boullier gave his buildings an immutable character. Cone-shaped cenotaphs incorporating ideas based on both domes and pyramids, with obelisks and cypresses much in evidence, monuments with flat surfaces, bare and unadorned, the decoration consisting of a play of shadows and gloomy, terrifying images incorporating abstractions and paraphrases recur in his work. So he's giving meaning. The architecture is designing with meaning in mind. the same way, yeah, Frank Lloyd Wright did. We have Canadian architects, some very famous Canadian architects today doing the same thing. When you hear the story, it's like listening to the libretto and seeing a translation of the of an opera. And then we sit and listen to see if the composer and the performers can pull it off. Can they draw from our soul, from our heart, the emotion that the composer had in mind to reveal the story? Terror and desolation, finality, stillness, and monumentality can be found in plenty of Bouygues' designs. I want to talk to you next time we get together. We'll talk a little bit more. Leave that. Again, it's a chewy little bit, but we're going to be meeting in May, aren't we, the next time we get together. Holy mackerel. And we'll talk just a little bit. Do you have a sense that we didn't grasp Egyptology the way that that other Grand Lodges or other jurisdictions may have? But if you've been to the Grand Lodge of Detroit, there is a lodge room. There's a few lodge rooms that are designed with themes. The Tudor room is particularly interesting for me. And when I went to Hampton Court last year, I was really taken with how well the motifs of the Tudor period were replicated in Detroit. But they have a lodge room that's done in an Egyptian. So it's not like they committed to one or another. They gave, being here in North America, they gave us a snapshot, a window of all these variations and themes. It's like saying, you know, opening up different books on the same subject. Fascinating to see the interpretations. Again, I'm not a big fan of the sort of the stark, stripped down versions, this minimalist lodge rooms that smell of worn out steps and mold. I'm not a fan of that at all. I think that's and not to be withering about it, but I think that's a reflection of poor husbandry, poor maintenance, poor builders. You would think that the builders, the structures that they would use would be some of the best, some of the most beautiful and up to date. Yeah. Anyway, let me plunge into living the enlightenment by just give you a little taste of something here, just about 4 minutes of something that I think will set this up, because, you know, I'm trying to help us all to understand the importance of constitution in the work that we do. Why is it so important that we operate within the constitutional framework? All its warts, all its scars, all its baggage, there's a critical fundamental importance. And we're going to get into that. This intense scholar, Margaret C. Jacob, has just opened up so much for us. Come right back. We're going to close your eyes again. If you're in a room where you can trust people not to be at your wallet, or even worse, be taking away your favorite beverage, get those people, you know, just take a minute here. Stretch out, take a deep breath, and check out the effect of this one. Thank you. Sets a tone, doesn't it? Sets a mood. Amazing. 62 bars. 62 bars of music can do that. Open your mind. Oh, don't worry. We'll be playing jazz and some country. We'll be playing some blues. We'll be playing some waltz music. Music of the 30s and 40s. Right now we're playing music that inspires a certain type of thought. Now we're going to talk a bit about the process of some of the processes inside the history of Freemasonry that we again find uncomfortable to admit. After all, we are supposed to be products of the Renaissance, aren't we? Products of that. We like to claim all of these things. We talk large, but, you know, it was a movement. It was a cultural movement. It was roughly somewhere between the 14th and 17th centuries. And it came out of Italy. Now, I've just finished a really interesting book, The Rise and Fall of the Medici. And we can begin to understand why Italy, why Venice, why Florence was so important. These were irascible types, the Medici. And it's difficult for me because I had to separate out the man from the accomplishments. And yet, the only reason I'm reading the book is because of the accomplishments. The arts thrived under their hand. Music, sculpture, paintings. And remember, this was a time when these types of expressions of humanity were frowned upon. Wasn't that long ago, about 1974, if you've been into the city square in Guelph, you see this remarkable sculpture of a family in a fountain. It's a gorgeous little piece. And when it was put up, the Philistines in the crowd wanted to cover the genitalia. We lie about death. We might as well lie about having genitals, hey? Smutty little minds make these things, make the naked form indecent. Oh, it has its place. There's bad form and there's good form. If I'm on a beach in southern France, that's good form. Grow up. That's the immaturity of the country and the immaturity of the culture we live in. We can look at the old cultures and we can yearn for that freedom, for that maturity where you can sit without the silliness and have a glass of wine in the middle of the day while you people watch and flip through your favorite newspaper. We can't quite get there yet. We still have a government that's trying to convince us, even now, that they should be the purveyors of sales of liquor. How ridiculous. How ridiculous. Something that man has been doing thousands of years before this government came along, this country came along. Here I'm going to talk, I want to explain a little bit through Margaret Jacobs' work about the mystical and magical. It's something we are hearing more and more. Men that are in the craft, and get over yourself. If you think this is just a young man's game, get over yourself. 60 is the new, what do I say, the new 30. 70 is the new 40. Everybody has access to, everybody has access to the internet. There you go, get over it. Everybody does, directly or indirectly, you have access to the internet, and everybody's learning. And you can sit there, and it's like going to the library without having to get up and park the car. It's excellent. Not that going to the library isn't exceptional, but it's pretty good. So the library of the mind that we've inherited is said to be, and claimed to be, the results of these, the Renaissance, this 300 years beginning, and it spread from Italy into Europe. And it was thought, although this was during the period of the invention of movable type, metal movable type, rather than wooden. And it sped, what that meant was that ideas could be shared. You could read, so everybody's reading the same page. And what that gave us was this incredible advantage of listening to different responses to the same page. Everybody wasn't the same. And did we pick up the intent of the author? It's like the intent of the drama in an opera. Does everyone come away with the same expression? No. But when you can allow yourself, your soul to be touched by music, by the arts, it means that you have let yourself become a student. And when you sit there before the performance or the piece or the art hanging on the wall, ask yourself, what was the artist trying to do and what is he doing to me? And then if you read a little bit about it, it won't kill you. As a cultural movement, though, the Renaissance encompassed innovative flowering of Latin and vernacular literatures. Remember, this was something that had been in the hands of the privileged, beginning with the 14th century resurgence of learning based on classical sources. And this changed perspective, and it gave new techniques of natural reality that came to painting and gradually influenced educational reform. And the politics, the Renaissance contributed to the development of conventions of diplomacy. In science, it increased the reliance on fact, on observation. Yeah? Historians often argue, though, that this intellectual transformation was a bridge between the Middle Ages and modern history.
Yeah.
Although the Renaissance saw revolutions in many intellectual pursuits, as well as social and political upheaval, it is perhaps best known for its artistic developments and the contributions of such polymaths. Polymaths, people that had incredible skills in a wide range of areas. And the two that we know, of course, Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo. And we know that Michelangelo was taken in by Cosimo de Medici. Yeah, taken in and allowed to look at the galleries and be inspired because the boy had talent. Thank goodness. There, generally, there's a consensus that the Renaissance began in Florence. And the dominant family, the patronage, this is the Medici, generation after generation, and the migration of Greek scholars to Italy. You're going where things are beautiful, ideas are beautiful, and unchallenged, you could go and be influenced. The Renaissance, though, is long and complex, and there's a lot of skepticism, yeah, and there's no question about that. But it is, as Edwin Panofsky said, it is perhaps no accident that the factuality of the Italian Renaissance has been most vigorously questioned by those who are not obliged to take a professional interest in the aesthetic aspects of civilization. Historians of economic and social developments, political and religious situations, and most particularly natural science, but only exceptionally by students of literature and hardly ever by historians of art. The use of the mystical and magical to express Masonic ideas might be imagined as always present in the movement, the legacy of its links to Renaissance humanism and Hermeticism. Yet both the British and continental records of 18th century Freemasonry present a more complex picture. So says Margaret Jacobs after her research. In the early part of the century, the mystical and magical elements of the Masonic legacy of the 17th century seem barely evident. Even the pantheism of Rousseau has a rationalist quality about it, with no excursions into the mystical as a way of expressing belief in nature as distinct from the belief in the Judeo-Christian God. This rationalist tone fits well enough with the nearly universal repudiation of religious enthusiasm, so characteristic of the early Enlightenment. The appearance of mystical language in a mid-century lodge that was clearly engaged in a radical departure from acceptable gender-exclusive Freemasonry focuses our attention on the potential for innovation within this unique fraternity. Its links with the Platonic and Hermetic traditions of the Renaissance, however tenuous by that time, made available a philosophical idealism that emphasized the mind or intellect as the sole criterion for judging the worthiness of an individual's merit and the quest for secret truth known only to the initiated. I don't know if I've ever heard it put more succinctly. Did you get that? Its links with the Platonic and Hermetic traditions of the Renaissance, however tenuous by that time, made available a philosophical idealism, that's us, that emphasized the mind or intellect as the sole criteria
the sole criteria for judging the worthiness of an individual's merit and the quest for secret truth known only to the initiated. What this is saying is you, your mind, your intellect is the order of highest judgment of merit. You, that alone within your mind, not your emotional state, not your clamor to be popular, to cover up some weak ego baggage, but that capacity to weigh competing ideas in the mind at the same time. This propensity toward the mystical within continental Freemasonry will surface increasingly during the second half of the 18th century. Out of this tendency came the mystical language of the radical Illuminati. Are we pretending that they didn't exist? No? Well, just a second. I'll take a poll in the room. Now, 100% of us in this room are agreeing that they did exist. You be the judge. You be the damn judge. Don't let me. This propensity toward the mystical will surface increasingly during the second half of the 18th century. And it became the mystical language of the radical Illuminati and other revolutionary secret societies modeled on the lodges. See, the lodge, there's something very interesting going on with the protections of the initiation and the process of initiation. That's excellent. There are no known links between those revolutionary secret societies and the earlier lodges of adoption. That isn't the point. What is important about Masonic idealism and its propensity to search for mystical language was the power it gave to circumstances as they imagined them transformed. The power it gave to men and women to express dreams and fantasies rooted in their contemporary circumstances as they imagined them transformed.
This gave you power. Sit back. Use the metaphysical to help you explain and understand. That language didn't exist before, even though we had those thoughts. This gave a form of expression. Think, go into your art galleries, go into your history books, and look at the changes in history over time. Changes in history expressed in art over time. And to begin to see that it is reflective. If you look for it, same kind of thing. The ideas didn't take form in the way until we had a medium, a way of expressing that idea that tells the story. In justifying this lodge, which met briefly in The Hague, brothers made reference to the myth of Plato's cave. If you read the Plato's Republic, you'll hear the tale he reveals, the sense of reality for people living in a cave. Even though up at the top there's an opening and they can see the sun, they can see light coming and going. But for them, unless they look over that edge, the reality is what it is inside the walls of the cave. I'm making a hack job of that one, I know. But the Plato's Republic is full of these thoughts that are those, aha, I knew, I heard that before. I had no idea where it came, where it was first written. In the 18th century, feminist sentiments can also be found in other Neoplatonic circles. The impulse to search for enlightenment could sometimes bring it recourse to illumination, particularly when the ideal bore so little relation to the reality around it. In Le Loge du Juste, mystical language provided the means for expressing egalitarian social behavior, which, if lived out in the real world of any European society at the time, would have been highly subversive. It is not incomprehensible, yet all this striving to build the temple of virtue, as prescribed by the ritual,
complete with secret signs and passwords, disguised as much as it illuminated. The primitive light that shone in the temple, to which women were suddenly being admitted, was in fact concealing the obvious. Never once is it mentioned in the rituals that new, normally forbidden worshippers, until that moment universally defined as profane, would now be admitted. These mystical rituals never once explain why this singular breach with tradition has occurred. See, admitting the, what was once defined as profane is a breach of tradition. So when we're talking, we're asked the question of the women in the lodge, it has something to do with this. We have to piece together the reasons for this event with a variety of other sources. Masonic reformers in the 1740s had demanded that women be admitted into the lodges on the grounds that sexual exclusivity contradicted their ideal of equality. In that decade, possibly in response to women having been admitted, French lodges specifically outlawed the practice, a prohibition not lifted officially until 1774. Yes, the French lodges. We need to consider the possibility that the Dutch lodges, familiar with the French Masonic literature, could not affect the same prohibition because they were forced to respond to local pressures coming from outside the lodges. Certainly, we have heard the hint of sexual slander in the attacks upon the order, particularly from the Calvinist ministry in the Republic. Remember the guff and stuff that was made up about what was really going on, the reasons why we were trying to exclude women? Remember that? Yeah. Sourced out to be the Calvinist ministry. Hard for any of us to live by those kind of, to be accepted by such rigid guidelines. My goodness. The Reform ministers were the same group who led the assault against sodomy that erupted in the Netherlands in the early 1730s. That persecution led to the execution of dozens of men accused of homosexuality, and was widely commented upon in the European journals of the day. The degree of hatred directed against homosexuals in the 1730s and beyond appears to have been uniquely Dutch, and historians have connected it to a general crisis in the Republic. It coincided with a revulsion against foreign influences and the persecution of booksellers, the supposed purveyors of ideas that were libertine and unorthodox. Surely that homophobic and xenophobic episode would have been remembered in the early 1750s. The persecution of homosexuals in the Dutch cities did not end in the 1730s. Less serious persecutions occurred in 1764 and 1776. Although none of the Masonic sources make mention of these events, we need to remember them and to bear in mind that in 1735, rioters in The Hague did bring up the charge of homosexuality against the Freemasons. These charges do not adequately account for the decisions of 1715 to step away from the male exclusivity for at least this one Dutch lodge. But this may have played a role. Sad. Other factors appear more obviously to account for the existence of La Loge de Duste. That's the lodge that had both male and female. The presence of William Benedict as a sponsor of the lodge places it among the many projects of reform with which he can be associated. He was, of course, a key figure in the Revolution of 1748 that restored the Stolthartrate as a Dutch Whig, probably the best description of his political goals. Bentinck wanted to see British institutions exported to the Republic And not least, he wanted to forge alliances amongst progressive groups sympathetic to the Anglo-Dutch alliance and the Stadtholderate. He wrote to his mother that he was appalled by our miserable constitution without any executive power. As curator of the University of Leiden, he took an interest in appointing liberal theologians within the faculty, and he was a promoter of scientific inquiry. His liberal approach to Freemasonry would be part of the same reforming mentality. In his way, Bentinck was a Republican who wanted to see a strong central government develop in the Republic as the guarantor of the Anglo-Dutch alliance, and in opposition to the corruption, as he imagined it, of the regions. We'll come back. Tough reading for Masons. Tough part of our history. That was the accusation. I still think, I'm always cautious. I don't take for granted the freedoms that we have today. When I think that, could it happen? When I ask myself, could it happen again? I think, yeah, sadly it could. Yeah, could happen again where we're being accused. Is that the, you know, it's like saying, has it improved? Do we have fewer right-wing zealots out there that, no, we don't. One of the reasons I can't have an open call-in is because when it was tried years ago, just after Masonic Companion was started, the files filled up with critics, very aggressive, nasty critics. And so I had to make a decision. I may try it again. I'm still, you know, trying to be cautious. But there are people out there that scan the universe looking for opportunities. And there's some very, very strange people in North America that I find that are willing to make life threats pretty casually. Scary little folks. And I don't want to say that I would think that they've had one too many head injuries, but I think sometimes they've had one too many head injuries. Well, anyway, I'm going to pay off a promise that I've made to all of you, right? This is something that, holy cow, I've been wanting to get into a game myself for so long. Today we're going to talk about, and we're going to wind up the show with how to drink like a Greek. I think you're going to like this. Remember, we set the beer aside, not too far out of reach, I would hope, and we have a glass of wine at hand now. So we're talking about the development of wine, history of wine. And this is just before we get into spirits, you know. We get into rum. Anyway, the drinks that built America, so to speak. But here we're talking about ancient times. What most distinguished the Greek approach to wine from that of other cultures was the Greek practice of mixing wine with water before consumption. The pinnacle of social sophistication was the consumption of the resulting mixture at a private drinking party or symposium. This was an all-male aristocratic ritual that took place in a special men's room or andron. Its walls were often decorated with drinking-related murals or paraphernalia, and the use of a special room emphasized the separation between everyday life and the symposium, during which different rules applied. The andron was sometimes the only room in the house with a stone floor which sloped toward the center to make cleaning easier. Its importance was such that houses were often designed around it. The men sat on special couches with a cushion under one arm, a fashion imported from the Near East in the 8th century BC. So, the Near East. Lounging. Typically, a dozen individuals attended a symposium, and certainly no more than 30. Interesting. Although women were not allowed to sit with the men, female servers, dancers, and musicians were often present.
Food was served first, with little or nothing to drink. Then the tables were cleared away, and the wine was brought out. The Athenian tradition was to pour three libations, one to the gods, one to fallen heroes, particularly one's ancestors, and one to Zeus, the king of the gods. A young woman might play the flute during the ceremony, and a hymn would then be sung. Garlands of flowers or vine leaves were handed out, and in some cases, perfume was applied. Then the drinking could begin. The wine was first mixed with water in a large urn-shaped bowl called a crater. Water from a three-handled vessel, the hydria, was then always added to wine rather than the other way around. The amount of water added determined how quickly everybody would become intoxicated. Typical mixture ratios of water to wine seem to have been 2 to 1, 5 to 1, 3 to 1, and 4 to 1, in that order. A mixture of equal parts of water and wine was regarded as strong wine. Some concentrated wines, which were boiled down before shipping to a half or third of their original volume, had to be mixed with 8 to even 20 times as much water. In hot weather, the wine was cooled by lowering it into a well or mixing it with snow, at least by those who could afford such extravagances. The snow was collected during the winter and kept in underground pits packed with straw to keep it from melting. Drinking even a fine wine without first mixing it with water was considered barbaric by the Greeks, and by the Athenians in particular. Oh. Only Dionysus, they believe, could drink unmixed wine without risk. He is often depicted drinking from a special type of vase, the use of which indicates that no water has been added. Mere mortals, in contrast, could only drink wine whose strength had been tempered with water. Otherwise, they would become extremely violent or even go mad. This was said by Herodotus, who to have happened to King Cleomenes of Sparta, who picked up the barbaric habit of drinking unmixed wine from the Scythians, a nomadic people from the region north of the Black Sea. Both they and their neighbors, the Thracians, were singled out by the Athenian philosopher Plato as being clueless and uncultured in their use of wine. The Scythians and Thracians, both men and women, drink unmixed wine, which they pour on their garments. And this they think a happy and glorious institution. Macedonians were also notorious for their fondness of unmixed wine. Alexander the Great and his father, Philip II, were both reputed to have been heavy drinkers. Alexander killed his friend Clitus in a drunken brawl, and there is some evidence that heavy wine drinking contributed to his death from a mysterious illness in 323. But it is difficult to evaluate the trustworthiness of such claims, since the equation of virtue with moderate drinking and corruption with overindulgence is so widespread in the ancient sources. Water made wine safe, but wine also made water safe. As well as being free of pathogens, wine contained natural antibacterial agents that are liberated during the fermentation process. The Greeks were unaware of this. Although they were familiar with the dangers of drinking contaminated water, they preferred water from springs and deep wells or rainwater collected in cisterns. The observation that wounds treated with wine were less likely to become affected than those treated with water, again because of the lack of pathogens and the presence of antibacterial agents, may also have suggested that wine had the power to clean and purify. Not drinking wine at all was considered just as bad as drinking it neat. The Greek practice of drinking wine and water was thus a middle ground between barbarians who overindulged and those who did not drink at all. Plutarch, a Greek writer from the later Roman period, put it this way: the drunkard is insolent and rude. On the other hand, the complete teetotaler is disagreeable and more fit for tending children than for presiding over a drinking party. Neither the Greeks believed, but was unable to make proper use of the gift of Dionysus. The
Greek ideal was to be somewhere between the two, somewhere between the teetotaler and the overindulgent. Ensuring that this was the case was the job of the symposiarch, or king of the symposium, either the host or one of the drinking party, chosen by ballot or a roll of the dice. Moderation was the key. The symposiarch's aim was to keep the assembled company on the borderline between sobriety and drunkenness so that they could enjoy the freedom of tongue and release from worry, but without becoming violent like barbarians. Wine was most frequently drunk from a shallow two-handled bowl with a short stem called a clytix. Man, gotta get this mouth working today. It was also sometimes served in a larger, deeper vessel called a cantharos, or a drinking horn called a rhyton. The wine jug, which in some cases resembled a long-handled ladle, was used by servants under the direction of the symposiarch to transfer wine from the crater to the drinking vessels. Once one crater had been emptied, another would be prepared. Drinking vessels were elaborately decorated, often with Dionysian imagery that became increasingly ornate. For pottery vessels, the classical form was the black figure technique, which figures and objects were represented by areas of black paint with details picked out by incising lines before firing. This technique, pioneered in Corinth in the 7th century BC, quickly spread to Athens. And from the 6th century BC, it was progressively replaced by the red figure technique, in which figures were depicted by leaving the natural red clay of the day unpainted and adding details in black. But it is the pottery vessels that survived because they were used in burials. The rich drank from silver or gold drinking vessels rather than pottery. There, how to drink like a Greek. And then next time you come, we're together, we're going to talk about, so what happens when things get out of hand at the best laid plans, huh? What happens? And we'll talk about what happens about the atmosphere of a crater, you know, the atmosphere of a symposium. But even today, we use the term symposium where we're to talk about, you know, to pull together discussion, and where people can sit in a relaxed atmosphere, more relaxed than usual, and talk, share ideas. But we just don't want necessarily to do that with the uninitiated or people that they haven't done a lick of, are full of opinion but have very little to add to the conversation. We need to be able to pull this together with people that have something to contribute. Anyway, I'm sitting here looking at the Secret Societies, a book on secret societies. I'm not even going to come close to getting in that today. I want to thank you, though, for tuning in and joining me again on Masonic Companion. I hope it's contributed a little bit to your thinking. Hopefully we've overlapped a little bit, and hopefully we've been a bit entertaining and a bit challenging. It's been an absolute pleasure. Remember, we have no sense of too many smiles or too much generosity or too much friendliness in the world. We're a very self-conscious culture, following the guidelines of a period in time when the expression of love between men had reached new bounds, when the literature, men in their writing with one another, were encouraged to find new depths of expression about the importance of their relationships. Looked at through today's eyes, it seems uncomfortable, but that is the period that is the foundation for Freemasonry. Agape, we can call it. It has a different language and a different meaning. I want to send you away today with a bit of music that I think is just transcendent.
It's gorgeous. Next time around, we'll get into some, maybe we'll get into some decent country, eh? And then some jazz. Anyway, take care of each other. Take care of yourself. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. And I'll see you soon. This week coming up, we'll be looking for the 200th anniversary. Yep, 200th anniversary of St. George's Lodge in St. Catharines. And we have a large number of things going on. It should be a really exciting time, and congratulations. The Friday night, I had the pleasure of the gathering of the three Hamilton Masonic districts celebrating a banquet for the Grand Master. It was exceptional. It was an exceptional experience, and I know that when we get to sit down again and share a meal and be entertained, and the setting is beautiful, that it's an expression of care and how important the host has made us feel, and how important the gifts are to the hosts. So if you're brown bagging it and handing somebody a sandwich and helping them get out the door as quick as possible, you may not be, you may want to see how it's done. It's not necessarily definitive, but those boys in Hamilton are pretty darn good. Anyway, great time to be here with you. Thanks. See you soon. Thank you.
his horn. As the light turned green, he changed the subject fast. Started talking about football as they drove right past. What do you say? Started drinking at some party till she was three sheets to the wind. Her mama always told her she could call no matter what. She was crying on the front steps when her mom showed up. Her husband knows she's tired of holding on. She looks at him and says, I wanna go home. What do you say in a moment like this, when you can't find the words to tell it like it is? Just close. Thank you.
A little indulgence, I hope you don't mind. After all, I am from Prince Edward Island. See you soon, boys. That's how you celebrate Freemasonry. Wow.